Hello and welcome to Profiles. I'm Kerry Boyce. Today I'm here with composer James McMillan, who has come to the forefront in the world of art music. And we're joined also by Professor Timothy Chance, professor at the University of Windsor, Ontario, Canada, and also by IU Jacobs School of Music Professor Carmen Tellez. Welcome to Profiles. We heard a world premiere of a work of yours, Sundogs. It's kind of an unusual name. Can you tell us just a bit about where that came from?
Yes, it's a setting of a poem by Michael Simmons Roberts, an English poet with whom I now have quite a long-lasting creative relationship. I've set many of his texts, and we actually worked together on new ideas from scratch, including a new opera we've just completed recently. But Sundogs is a poem he wrote before I met him. Like many of his poems, there's an elusive quality to the meaning of the poem, and it's a very rich and complex work. But for him, the idea sprang from the words itself, sun dogs. This is an astronomical phenomenon that under certain conditions one can see, or one is aware of, little accompanying suns, little spots, as it were, at the bottom of the sun, which look like dogs, or have been traditionally over the centuries referred to as dogs, or mock suns, sun dogs, mock suns, little suns, little dogs. And this intrigued him, and he got going. He very quickly took the astronomical phenomenon into the realm of the animal, began to wonder what these dogs would be like if they were real. The association with the sun gave them a certain vividness and violence, perhaps. But then, as the mind raced, as it tends to do with poets, he realised that dogs have a very important place in theological, historical, mythological life of the culture, and began to make references to these, and very gradually a whole new layer of meaning and significance of dogs in our culture began to arise. The association with beggars in Europe and the mendicant orders like the Dominicans. In fact, the term Dominicanus is mentioned at one point in the poem, which simply means dogs of the Lord, which of course is the nickname of the Dominican order.
Is that where it came from? It sounds much the same, Dominicanus and Dominicans.
Well, it's a good question. The founder of the order was, of course, Saint Dominic. And his mother, when she was pregnant with Dominic, had a dream that she gave birth to a dog and that this dog had a torch in its mouth and went through the world setting it alight with the love of God, is the significance or the symbolism there. So whether, I don't know which came first, but it's a curious connection that Dominic's order are known as the Dogs of the Lord, the Dominicanus. I myself am a lay Dominican. That means a member of the third order, the lay section of the Dominicans. So I'm very close to the Dominicans, and I've in fact dedicated the work to the Dominicans, the whole order, as it were.
The worldwide order.
That's right. Uh-huh. And I was very fortunate, and I was so pleased that unknown to me there were Dominicans present here in Bloomington. They are the parish pastors, priests of the University Parish of St. Paul. And once that was discovered, we made connections with them, and the University Music Department invited them to the premiere, and we dined with them the night before. It was a lovely experience to have them involved in that way.
This piece was commissioned in part by the Indiana University Jacobs School of Music, and it was conducted by Carmen Elena Tellez. Can you tell us just a bit, perhaps, about how this commission came together? There were other ensembles involved, yeah?
That's right. There are four ensembles altogether, one in the US here, one in Canada, one in England, and then one in Holland. But I've been aware from a distance that my music has been performed here in Indiana, and that Carmen Tellez has championed a lot of my choral music over the years, and I've heard some great reports about the school and its musical activities, its choral activities especially, through my agents Boozing Hawks, some of whom have studied here and that sort of thing. So when I heard that they were interested in actually being involved in a commission, I was delighted to follow that through, and then when it worked out, I was able to come to the premiere here in the US. It was a very nice opportunity.
Let's hear the last two movements of the world premiere of Sundogs. It's conducted by Carmen Teos with the Indiana Jacobs School of Music Contemporary Vocal Ensemble.
Thank you.
I wondered sometimes maybe how your Scottish background plays into your musical style.
Well, I think subliminally it does, but also I've been involved in the practical side of the performance of Scottish and Irish traditional music when I was younger. I used to play in a folk band that used to play about the folk clubs and the pubs in the west of Scotland, and I learned in a sort of hands-on experience what it would be like to perform that kind of music. And I think it does go under the skin creatively, that some of the modality that is associated with Gaelic music, Celtic music, the ornamentation, that the rich ornamentation that you get in a lot of pibroch music, the bagpipe, classical music, but also the way that Scots and Irish fiddlers ornament lines, singers as well, whether it be the secular ballads in Scotland or indeed the Gaelic psalm singing from the Western Isles, highly decorated and quite strange music. I think the experience of working with that, the engagement with all that kind of rich tradition in a practical way has had an impact. Many composers in Scotland are drawn to Scottish traditional music one way or another. I think it's something to do with the fact that, in general terms, Scotland, for a couple of significant reasons, felt peripheral to the general thrust of the development of art music in Europe. Consequently, we developed an alternative art tradition, some of it was an art tradition, some of it was a folk tradition, and that rich heritage, which is quite separate and distinct from what was happening in Germany and France and Italy, has become a reservoir of experiment and exploration for many composers today.
Your influences actually are many, though. You have not just that background, but you have, a fair amount of classical training as well.
Yes, that's right. I had to relearn the Scottish folk tradition as someone in his 20s, really, because growing up I was fully engaged with, whether you want to call it a European art music, or now obviously it's a world international culture of art music, that was what inspired me to become a musician and a composer in the first place. Like many composers in many different countries, one begins to develop curiosities in non-European cultures or non-mainstream European cultures, whether it be folk cultures or, in the case of people like Philip Glass and Steve Reich, John Cage, an interest in Eastern music or African music, South American music. Those composers, one way or another, have gone about trying to absorb something of those influences into their own character.
Let's go now to the final movement from James McMillan's Seven Last Words. The London Chamber Orchestra and Chorus is conducted here by James McMillan. Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit.
Thank you.
Tim has been politely quiet listening to all of this.
I just wanted to jump in because I wanted to follow up on some of the influences, because I know that Peter Maxwell Davies has been an influence, but also you've worked with him and perhaps even taken over some of his roles on certain events. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, Peter Maxwell Davies was a huge inspiration to me, still is a huge inspiration to me, because he was the first composer I became aware of as a teenager that was obviously active and busy in the world and in the community, in society, as a living composer, and that society noticed him, and that he responded to that society, not just in writing these amazing, complex and exploratory works, but also writing music for ordinary people, non-specialist musicians, whether they be amateur orchestras, amateur choirs, school musicians, young players, community ensembles. He even formed a festival in the Orkney Islands in the north of Scotland, the St. Magnus Festival, which is very much a community festival, but has some of the greatest musicians in the world come there and perform. And it struck me that there was indeed a role for the living composer in society, and a composer could make it his role to have a significance or an input into society, rather than simply be some kind of peripheral figure in an ivory tower that has no impact or resonance with his or her context. And that is was a great inspiration for me, to see that there was some real relevance for a composer, and I suppose it encourages young composers to keep going when you see something like that working well.
So Maxwell Davies is someone that you obviously work with and have collaborated with as well, whether it would be for this Orkney Festival or for other events. So would you say that he's a composer that you have picked up information in speaking with him as well as his music? I mean, obviously you've been in touch with his music, but mm-hmm. you have a relationship with him as well.
Yes, he was never my teacher as such, but I do regard him as a kind of mentor figure, whether it's a father figure or a big brother figure, I'm not quite sure. He's in his 70s now, but still a very active man, an inspiring man, and he's a bit of a polemicist as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that inspired me to take my own polemics, whether they're about music or the wider culture or certain political things. Max has contributed perspectives on all those things through his life, and they've been valid and important contributions. I think in certain countries there is a tradition of writers especially being able to be involved in public discourse in some way. Maybe not so much composers, because composers deal with something more than words. But nevertheless, I think it's important for composers to be engaged one way or another in the general public discussion about where our culture is going.
Next, we'll hear Cantos Sagrados by James McMillan, the first movement, Identity, with the London Chamber Orchestra and chorus.
Not even his mother who bore him.
From the studios of WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, you're listening to Profiles. I'm Kerry Boyce, and I'm here with composer James McMillan and Professor Tim Shantz of the University of Windsor, Ontario, Canada. Sometimes I've heard criticisms of artists for being too active politically. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you are very active politically, so you would disagree with the stance that artists or entertainers should not engage in cultural dialogues?
Well,
political dialogues?
It's an interesting question. I don't necessarily totally disagree with the criticism, and sometimes I take it on board. I think I personally also find it quite irritating to see sometimes when artists or entertainers with really no knowledge of a subject other than their own jump out of the box, as it were, and get involved in what can seem a very attention-seeking involvement in political dialogue. I won't name any names. Okay. I saw one of them on the television this morning, actually. But they're usually from the world of pop and Hollywood and film and so on. So, I mean, they it's very easy to exploit that very, very public persona.
Do you find that sometimes your musical interests and your political ones contradict each other or intersect?
A bit of both, perhaps, yes. I'd say politically, I'd only use that word with a very small p. Now, as a younger man, I was very active politically, party politically, and all the rest of it. But I'm afraid I've lost all my youthful certainties on the matters of politics, and I'm very much an agnostic politically. And what I mean by that, I hear arguments that maybe 20, 30 years ago I wouldn't have listened to. The arrogance of youth sometimes discounts and cuts out opposing views, and that has changed, and I feel better for it. It's not to say that I entertain extremist views one way or another, but I do hear a plethora of views that I realise I'd never really engaged with at all. And I find it enriching to be, in a sense, more open, more agnostic, if you like. But it doesn't mean that, therefore, I'm politically neutral. Maybe with a little bit of perspective and maturity, one can offer more of a perspective from a position of neutrality or a position of detachment, a political detachment, where one is not as emotionally or polemically involved with one side against the other. So in that sense, you know, and back home in Scotland, for example, I've taken part in debates about our culture one way or another. Our national opera company is continuously under threat through philistinism at a governmental level and lack of funding. And I've seen it as important for me to be involved in defending Scottish opera as one of the best things about our culture against people who see the very term Scottish opera as a kind of oxymoron, because we don't have an indigenous opera culture, but unlike some other European countries. But it's a question of how we see ourselves as Scots, whether we can embrace a bigger view of what it means to be Scottish, and that means not just folk music or even the narrow focus on identity questions, but the desire to expand what it means to be Scottish, taking it on board international currents, being part of an international culture, whether that involves opera, the high arts, and an interaction of discussion amongst nations. And of course that then jumps into the whole area of what Scotland is doing politically. I don't know if people over here in the States know too much about what's been happening in Scotland, but we've got our own parliament now, which is a kind of federal parliament. We call it devolution. And I've always supported that, but I see negative developments as well. It means that we are closing down our view of ourselves. The Scottish media only talk about themselves and ourselves, and tend to withdraw from the world. And that's not what supporters of devolution expected to happen. So that I'll be quite honest and sometimes put my hand up and say I made a mistake, and that maybe the devolution experiment had hidden hazards which we're now facing.
And your religious views, do they sometimes step over into your political arenas?
It's not just me that sees a parallel sometimes between religion and politics. One sees religion and politics interacting and engaging and intertwining all through the world, for good and for ill. One could say that the Christian Gospels are political tracts in a certain level. In that there's a preferential option for the dispossessed and the poor. And one can understand how certain theologies like liberation theology grew up. And maybe sometimes that theology took a wrong-headed direction, but the instinct is absolutely genuine to take a preferential option for those who can't defend themselves, the weak, the dispossessed.
This is a recurring theme, by the way, in some of your music, Cantos Sagrados, for example.
That's right. Cantos Sagrados is a work which is really a setting of secular poems, sometimes by aggressively secular writers like Ariel Dorfman, but intertwined with resonating, interlinked sacred texts. So there are sometimes raised eyebrows when they see a work of mine called Cantos Sagrados, which is Spanish for sacred songs, and then they discover that it's actually Ariel Dorfman's work that's being set. I'm very intrigued by that potential contradiction, but also the potential parallelism between the secular and the sacred, between the political and the religious. And Cantos Sagrados is one work where I explored it. Another work is Búsqueda, which is another Spanish word meaning search, which is a setting, if that's the right word, of the poems by the Mothers of the Disappeared from Argentina. But those poems are interlaced with the Latin text of the Mass. The poems are resonant of those liturgical instincts. One can feel deep in the words of women who are suffering the loss of their children or their loved ones, the great cry from liturgy, Lord have mercy, Kyrie eleison, and a cry for peace and solace. And it seemed entirely natural then that for me to bring the two worlds together.
So other composers have done that, Sting, for example.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and you can see that happening in many different parts of the arts.
Let's take a break here and hear the Kyrie from James MacMillan's Mass.
Thank you.
Tim actually has an advantage in that he's kind of the Macmillan specialist, and he actually has a chance to talk with a composer who's still breathing.
That's wonderful.
It offers certain advantages, I suppose.
Well, it's definitely, and to have someone who's also very prolific and very much busy in his work as a composer. So no one person could ever keep up with all of it. Actually, there's many people that have enjoy the music as performers, as conductors, as audience members, but then there are others, scholars, who have done some work looking at some of your background, and it's very interesting to trace as someone is active and is actually working on their craft.
And how do you find it? How do you find the dialogues themselves? I mean, is it odd for a composer to be the subject of a research paper when you're still alive?
It's slightly unnerving, I must admit. but it's—I'll be honest—I'm absolutely delighted that there is an interest at that kind of level in universities, in the work of the living composer.
And we've been joined by conductor Carmen Tejas, who conducted the premiere of Sundogs, and she actually had some questions about the Dominican influence.
Yes, I wondered if James could talk a little bit about what he thinks is the role of the composer in expressing religious ideas, or how does he see his music as being part of a tradition that spans centuries, especially in the Catholic Church?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a very interesting question, and can sometimes be a controversial area, because there's so many different perspectives on the relationship between music and religion, or music and spirituality, or whatever. But I think what binds all the perspectives together is a common feeling amongst people who love music, that there is something deeply spiritual about the nature of music itself. And many people will say that music is the most spiritual of the arts. And there's a whole range of people who talk in those terms, certainly not just religious people, but a whole range of people who are quite sceptical about religion, for example, but will still, nevertheless, use pseudo-spiritual analogies in the way that they describe the impact of music on their lives, the way that music transforms their lives, has a huge impact on their life, some way changing their lives, opening perspectives and understandings and things, having an impact in their relationships, their moods as well, of course. And I think with this discussion of music in those terms, we're sort of circling around a certain fundamental archetypal truth about music that as someone from my tradition would see it, it's a kind of window into the working of the mind of God. And in that sense, I do see music as being analogous to the power of God or the grace of God in some way, and indeed sometimes may even be the same thing. So I do see it as a powerful spiritual thing. And because of that, and because so many people want to sort of tease out the meaning of music on these terms, I don't see the fact that my music is written from a particular worldview as being in any way divisive or keeping people at bay that maybe have very different views from me on these matters. It's the power of the spiritual power of music that, in a sense, it is the universal language and binds us all together, and therefore I'm speaking as a musician in my music a universal language which I hope communicates to many people regardless of what they believe about matters of the divine.
So do you see a role for music in the church again?
Yes, again, it's a controversial area because I think it's generally regarded inside and outside of the Catholic Church that the church has problems with its music. And I think looking back on Vatican II, which was a great thing for the church, it opened it up in many ways. It allowed us to engage with modernity. But I think there has been a few misunderstandings in the liturgy about just what communication and involvement actually mean, because many people took that to mean open season on the great musical traditions of the church, and everything was thrown out. The baby, perhaps, was thrown out with the bathwater. And we abandoned so much that was good. And it necessitated a rethinking about the music as well, because there wasn't enough liturgical music in those vernacular languages. But it did mean, unfortunately, that the kind of music that infused the vacuum was music of the lowest common denominator, music which did not have a prayerfulness, did not have a sense of awe in the presence of the divine, which depoeticized the liturgy, desacralized the liturgy perhaps, and a lot of very well-meaning liturgists who thought they were using folk music but actually were producing something that as a real folk enthusiast, I could see wasn't anything to do with folk music, but was a kind of manufactured, saccharine, sentimentalised commercial music. They, in a sense, damaged the way that the liturgy was perceived by people. And I think now that we've had 30, 40 years of that, we need time now to take stock. And that's what the church is doing. They're realising that there are problems with the liturgy, and that those problems in many cases are musical, and that new ways, as well as an accepting of some of the old ways, are now on the agenda again. And I think that's a good thing. And our new Pope, Benedict, is of course a musician.
I didn't know that.
Absolutely, a very, very good pianist. He is the first pope to have brought a grand piano into the Vatican, and plays Mozart very well, apparently. His brother is a composer and music master in one of the, retired now, in one of the big German cathedrals. And he has real concerns and a dedication to liturgical music, and wants to see things improve. And on that level, I'm very pleased that Benedict's here.
Are you influenced at all by popular music?
As a composer? Mm-hmm. I think in time, yes. Over the years, there's been various things have infused a certain approach to rhythm in some of my orchestral music, which I think chimes with other composers' interest in dance. I'm thinking particular of composers like Stravinsky and Copland, composers who wrote for the ballet as well. And I've been very lucky recently to have done that. My second piano concerto was written for the New York City Ballet a few years ago, and I was involved in that, working, collaborating with Christopher Wheeldon, the choreographer, the English choreographer. And that's another collaboration which can be very fruitful, and hopefully it's a relationship that will take off as well in the future.
And that brings us to the conclusion of our interview with composer James McMillan. Thank you very much for coming.
You're very welcome.
And we've been joined today by Dr. Carmen Tejas and Professor Timothy Shantz. Thank you both for coming. For WFIU Public Radio, I'm Kerry Boyce. Thanks for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in August of 2006. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily Blacklin McCord, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.